So I'm going to start this morning asking some, not trivia questions, but maybe some geographical questions. If you would have wanted to go, let's say you would have been alive at 30 AD, the time when Jesus was ministering, where would you have gone? Let's say you say, I really want to go and meet this Jesus guy. Where would you probably have gone? What town?
Capernaum.
Maybe Jerusalem if he was there. He was there a few times, but his main headquarters were in Capernaum. And this particular building here is the synagogue in Capernaum. It is not the actual synagogue that Jesus lived in. It was the foundation of the synagogue is below this one. In fact, you can see the line there of the earlier colors foundation. But it probably looks similar, but the one that Jesus would have attended was destroyed. And then they built this one on top, probably about 100 years after Christ. Interestingly enough, maybe from here down to the ball field, is where Peter's house was. And so they hung out together a lot at Peter's house. So between the synagogue and Peter's house, this is where Jesus would have spent a lot of time. And Jesus spent a lot of time relating to people. The book of John, and what we're going to do this morning is do a fast flyover of the book of John. I'm a big picture person. And if you understand what was John doing when he wrote his book, why is he writing this way, it really helps you to get some of the details. So I'd like for you to turn to John chapter 1, verse 12. And one of the things that John does in his writing, he did not write one of the synoptics. The three synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, were written early. Mark was probably the first gospel they had, and it's really Peter's story. And John wrote his gospel as an old man, an old pastor, probably living in Ephesus. And he probably had read the other accounts. And so John left out a lot of the details as to his personal life. You're not going to find much about what happened in Bethlehem and John. But John's book is more theological in nature. And anytime John lays out a detail, he always fills it in with something very important. So there's a lot of new information in the book of John. And one of the things you will see is John really focuses in on Jesus' personal interactions with people. A lot of the teachings that we get out of that is Jesus relating to maybe one person, two people, or maybe a handful of people. And some incredible teaching that takes place there. And so the book of John is full of relationships. And notice what John says as he begins his gospel. Verse 12, but to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, and the word believe is very important in the book of John, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. Some kind of a miraculous birth, because it's not natural. It cannot be explained natural. But he is inviting us to become the children of God. That is a relationship unlike anything understood in the Old Testament. It was in the Old Testament, it was Jehovah, where you don't even write the name without maybe taking a bath when you're copying the scripture. God was sacred and holy, and he was to be feared and revered. And there is a sense where that is true, but Jesus is inviting us into a child-father-like relationship. And if you turn into just before Jesus went to the cross in John chapter 13, for the first time, John records that he refers to them as children. I want to highlight that. John 13, verse 39, little children, yet a little while I am with you. Notice that endearing familial term. He calls them children. That is a very different kind of relationship that suddenly we can have with God. And I want you to understand it's only because of what Jesus did in his ministry that we can have that kind of a relationship. And then Jesus goes on to talk about some more relationship stuff. In relationships, we love. We treat each other with respect. And notice he said, where I am going, you cannot come. Down to 34. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another just as I have loved you. And he even says something that we're all a little squeamish about, because we know we don't do well in this. By this will people know that you're a disciple of mine, if you're a loving person. If relationships are important to you, it's in relationship that love begins to be fleshed out. And Jesus just made it very cut and dry. He said, people are going to see how you relate to each other. And that's either going to repel them, I want out of here, I want nothing to do with that, or it's going to attract them. You ever heard people say, if that's what a Christian is like, I don't want to be one? I've heard it. I heard people say that. And they had legitimate reason for saying it. And so there's a lot that we can learn about relationships in the book of John as we quickly do a flyover into this. We're going to look real quick at about 7 different relationships. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on each one, but just give you just a little picture. What was Jesus trying to teach, and what can I learn from that? And what maybe should I be looking for somebody that I can teach that to as well? So the first one, and I love this, John 1:35 to 51, where John records the first encounters with the disciples. It's a little different from the others. But they were walking down the road. I'm just going to tell the story rather than reading it. Jesus came walking by, and several of John's disciples were standing there, and Jesus made a very unusual statement. He said, look, the Lamb of God. And these guys were, the Lamb of God? That was a very, very loaded statement. And so several of these disciples followed. We know one was Andrew and the other one was unnamed. And so that makes me think maybe it was John, because when John refers to himself, he never uses his name in the book of John. So maybe it was John. We don't know that. But two disciples went, and they said they started following Jesus. And I don't know what you would say if you would meet an important person today, but you probably wouldn't say what they did. Because they probably didn't know what. They're saying, where are you staying? It's like, that's none of your business, you would think. But that, I don't know if they said that because they didn't know what to say, but they said, where are you staying? And here was this important man who stopped and said, come and see. I love that invitation. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and they hung out with where Jesus was staying the rest of the day. And they were convinced, we want to follow this guy. love to be able to have sat in on that conversation that took place as they talked. The next day, Jesus invited Philip. And Philip goes to his friend and says, and they begin to do what happens. If you're excited, you begin to invite others. And Nathaniel, which is likely Bartholomew, he was like, this guy's from Nazareth. What are you talking about? That's worse than West Virginia. and he was like, well, come and see. You've got to see. And I wish we could. I think what we see here is a beautiful thing. What are you looking for? And Peter says, or Jesus says, come and see. To me, that wraps up the whole thing about Jesus. It's an invitation. Come. Hang out. Come see. And once we experience that, you start interacting with your neighbors. What are you going to say? Same thing, what Philip said, come and see. If you really understand what relationship with God is. The second one is Nicodemus, chapter 3. Chapter 2, we have a miracle. But here we have now, so I would like to say that that first group of people, they were seekers. We have many opportunities today to meet seekers. And hopefully we are a bit of a seeker. If we're not, we're not going to find much. But when we meet seekers, the word should always be come and see. So here was now an intellectual. Nicodemus was a leader. He was part of the Sanhedrin. He had studied under the rabbis. This guy knew his theology. He was a good guy. But the thing that really, the key phrase from Nicodemus was, how can these things be? He says, we've seen the miracles that you did. Jesus had just turned water into wine. We've seen the miracles. It's not logical what you're doing. And then Jesus says, you have to be born again. And Nicodemus' mind went poof, you know. He was a logical man. It's like, I don't know what you're talking about. This is unbelievable. But you know, a relationship with God, if you're going to have a real relationship with God, you have to learn to believe the unbelievable. And believe, in that conversation, Jesus kept bringing up, you've got to believe. You've got to believe. You have to believe something that in your logic makes no sense. But our favorite verse, John 3:16, what does it say? Who are the people that become saved in the end? The ones who believe. So Jesus is trying to hammer this home with a very intellectual guy. I don't know, it's still a mystery. Did he walk out of there a believer or not? It may have been a journey, and often for intellectual people, it is a journey. But eventually, he was convinced, and Nicodemus believed. Jesus' words to him were, come to the light. Turn yourself to where the light is shining. Come to the light and believe. That was an interaction that John spent almost a whole chapter. And, you know, so the unbelievable, just think about this, guys. To help Nicodemus understand this unbelievable thing, Jesus had just turned water to wine. Can he take an old heart of stone and make that heart into a heart of flesh as the Old Testament prophesied? Can he do that? That's a miracle. It's like turning water to wine. And he can do that. But you have to believe. It's not something that you can go to the lab and demonstrate. because it's not a scientific idea. Labs are great, but some stuff is beyond science, and we just have to understand that. So here is a house. This is what a first century house would have looked like over in Israel. And I just, as I look at those houses, I would love to have gone to one of those houses and just had a conversation. But John is helping us by what he is giving us here in his gospel. This is what the conversations would have been like, because he is recording these conversations for us. Inside, it would have looked a little bit like that. The third one is a woman at the well. And I was talking about this to some students this past week, and I said, the woman at the well is not the kind of lady you would have wanted your brother to hang out with. She was not a good lady. But she was a seeker, looking for affirmation in all the wrong places. That's what she really was. She was looking for a relationship in all the wrong places, and Jesus knew that. And he decided, I'm going to spend time with this lady. And John records the conversation. And what they found out, she discovered quickly he knew everything about her. There was nothing he knew all about the different men that she had been with, and the one that you're with now is not your husband. And it's like, can't hide anything from this guy. But despite knowing that, most of us, if we'd have known that information, we would have said, oh. And we would have grabbed our stuff and we'd have been out of there. We wouldn't want to hang around that kind of a lady. If we'd see her coming down the sidewalk, we'd make sure we're on the other side of the street. But Jesus said, no, I'm going to spend time with her. And he offered her what? You know the story.
Living water.
Did she deserve it? No. He was trying to teach her and us. She deserved nothing. And what did God give her? Everything. And you know, guys, that is how God described himself in the Old Testament. That's the kind of God I am. When you have a right to expect nothing, I will give you everything. How many of you love to, when somebody gives you a free handout? Few of us. Let's be honest. How many of you, it's a little bit hard to take something for free? Any of you there? I'm there. Well, I'll tell you what, if you want a relationship with Christ, there's only one way to get it. If you're going to try to earn it, you'll never get it. It has to come from, it's free. You don't earn it, it is a free gift. And usually the ones who maybe deserve it the least sometimes understand it. Notice what this lady did. She turned around and she was an evangelist. And she was telling the whole town, come and see. Because she understood what it means. And some of us, we try to earn our way into that house with Jesus. It can't be done. You have to learn to accept his free gift. Then you have the woman accused of adultery. And this was another bad lady, okay? She was caught red-handed. Now, I realize they were using her for wrong purposes, but the situation was probably true. And they were saying, this lady deserves to be stoned. What are you going to do about it? And Jesus basically said, you're right. She deserves to be stoned. That's what she deserves. But he made it very clear, and it's still a mystery how he did it. We'd love to know a little more detail there. But he made it very clear, the person who throws the first stone is the one who is not sinful himself. Is that a lesson on judging each other? And you know, back, if you go back to his conversation with Nicodemus, Jesus said, I did not come to judge. In fact, Jesus redefines sin if you look at it, that conversation. If I would ask you, what is sin? I mean, we could fill the room up with sins, right? Jesus said there's really basically one sin, and that is not believing on the one who can set you free from every sin. And so Jesus says, I don't need to judge you. You will judge yourself. Because as the judge, he paid the penalty. So we're free if we're willing to accept it. So we end up judging ourselves. So Jesus tells this lady, I don't judge you either. I'm going to set you free. What would happen if that would be our mentality as we look at bad people around us? Rather than judging them, we're here to set free. Jesus said, you'll know the truth, and what will the truth do for people? Sets you free. Go and leave your sin. And he is a judge that judges no one. This picture here goes back to the woman at the well. This is up at Tel Dan, up in the very north part of Israel. You remember the term from Dan to Beersheba. And there's a little bridge across this, and this is just water gushing down. And if you would go a few hundred feet beyond it, it's just coming right out of the ground. Great example of that living water just bursting forth out of the ground that Jesus is offering to people. For what? What's the price? It's free. Gotta learn to take something for free. So let's look quickly at Mary's radical act of devotion. This was, you know the story, how in John chapter 11, where he raised Lazarus from the dead. Very fascinating story, because it was very important that Lazarus was dead beyond 3 days. Because in Jewish culture, that is when corruption began, after the third day. That's why Jesus could not be dead that long, because corruption could not happen for him. But it was very important that Lazarus was, because one of the messianic miracles that they believed that the Messiah would do is he would raise someone from the dead after corruption began. So Jesus, that's what he did. Made sure that it happened so that they would understand. And so Mary just is, her heart is just flowing over out of gratitude and love for Jesus. And she takes something that cost 300 denarii, which is basically a year's wages. It might have been a family heirloom. But she took a year's wages worth of the most expensive perfume and broke it open and just spilled it all over Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair while she was crying. Peter was standing by, Judas, polar opposite from Mary here. And he protested. He said, this is a waste. This act of devotion is a waste. Jesus came to her defense. And think about it. Judas' 30 pieces that he uses later in betraying Jesus, Mary took 30 times that, 300, in her act of devotion to Jesus. Sometimes we are the Marys. Sometimes we are the Judas in the room. But I will tell you, there is nothing that you will do in your devotion to Christ that's too much. Jesus makes that very clear in this little interaction. The washing of the disciples' feet, we know that story well. So John doesn't use any parables. There's no parables. Luke has the parables. But John actually portrays the life of Jesus in many ways as a parable in itself. And certainly what happened here was a parable. So the disciples were constantly bickering, and they just let it all hang out. Who's the best? Who's the greatest? Who gets to sit next to Jesus? Now, we're a little more civilized in our discussion about who's the greatest. We wouldn't talk that way. And yet, that little bickering and that shuffling for getting up to the top still happens. We do it in more dignified ways. But it's still there. And Jesus said, you want to be somebody? You have to learn to be a servant. Goes totally opposite from the grain of every way that I'm wired. And yet, that's very important. This is one of my favorite, Mary Magdalene. You might want to turn to chapter 20. So imagine, so Jesus is wanting to invite people to a relationship with God. What was the thing in the way? Why was this so impossible? Why are relationships, a really one-to-one relationship with God, why was it impossible ever since the fall? Sin. Jesus has now taken care of the sin problem. And I'll tell you, when it comes to the big picture, what was probably in the history of the earth the greatest day the earth ever experienced so far was Resurrection Day. It was the biggest event ever. And what's Mary doing? She's crying. And I used to wonder, it finally hit me just recently why the angels were like, what in the world is wrong with you? Why are you crying? You should be jumping for joy. He was an angel. He didn't understand people. And he was... People are just really crazy. Why are you crying? Do you not realize what just happened? Now, maybe he understood. I don't know. But Jesus asked her the same question. He goes, woman, why are you weeping? But when Jesus, all he needs to do, and there was something a little mysterious about Jesus after the resurrection. You didn't always recognize him. Maybe it was because it was so beyond logic that this guy's alive that something wasn't registering. But when she heard him say her name, it clicked. And she fell at his feet, and my guess is she just clung to him. And I used to wonder and puzzle over that statement. What was it about it? Were you not supposed to touch Jesus yet? And yet he invited Thomas to come touch him. I don't know if Thomas ever did. Doesn't say whether he did. But I'm picturing Mary just hanging on, and he just kind of laughingly says, Mary, you don't have to hang on to me. I haven't left yet. He's kind of laughing with her. Jesus is excited. Why? Because look what he gets to tell her next. He says, for the first time, he says, and notice he repeats it to make sure she gets it. I am going to my father and, say it, your father. My God and you understand what just happened? When sin was taken care of, suddenly the door is wide open for a relationship with God. And Jesus, for the first time, introduced her to her father. It was an amazing moment that just took place there. And do we know him? And the last one here, it's time we finish this up. Peter at the second catch of fish. And sometimes we get hung up in the three times that Jesus asked Peter, do you love me? And there may be a connection to his denial. I don't know, but I have the Bible would indicate that they had actually had a personal meeting before this. And my guess is that's the first thing Peter needed to take care of. So that was probably already taken care of. But notice the sequence as you follow down through here in chapter 21. He ends up both times, feed my sheep. But then he comes and he tells the last thing. What's the last thing, guys? You can see it there in your Bible. What's the last thing that is John records in that initial conversation before they got on the topic of John? He says, follow me. Was that the first time Jesus asked John to follow him? No, we have it recorded. But notice that all the way up to this time, Peter was trying to follow Jesus in whose strength? Peter's strength. Did it work out well for him? And this is one of the things I think we can see here in this little interaction is when we choose to become a disciple of Christ, if you're really going to do this and you really mean business, you can't just be doing the stuff that you can easily do. Oh, I can do that. No sweat. So sure, sign me up for that. Following Jesus truly in the way that God is calling Peter is beyond what you're able to do. So if I would tell you, he just got done telling Peter, Peter, you're going to be crucified if you choose to follow me. That's what stretching your hands out meant. They all knew that terminology. If God would tell you, if you follow me, you're going to have to die for me. How many of you would think twice? I would. I'm like, seriously? I can only do this if you're with me. And he promised to be with us. So there's something about this conversation that says, if you're really going to follow Jesus, it has to be at the level where you can only do it with his strength. If you try doing it on your own, you're going to end up just like Peter. It has to be at the level where you have to depend on him. So you and I, John chapter 22, which there is no John chapter 22. It's being written today. Where are we in our relationship with Jesus? Do I really know Jesus? And am I reaching out to others and teaching these same things in relationships with them? That is the most effective way to be reaching out to people. So I close with these three questions these are pictures I took at the Sea of Galilee. Do I know him? Do I really know him? He's inviting us to come and see. But unless you are in a deep personal relationship, I'll guarantee you, you don't know him well. I don't know him well. Am I committed to follow? This is sitting right on the banks of Capernaum. What if it means some really nasty stuff? That's what people around the world today are having to answer. That's why they think twice, can I really go through with this? Because it's going to cost me. And am I inviting others to come and see? Is my life such a life that people have any interest in following me to come and find more out about Jesus? And I'll close with that question.